From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
My landlord marketed it to me as Temescal, but it's actually Golden Gate.
Realm 50.
I actually don't live in Oakland, I live in Richmond.
Coming up, we'll visit an Oakland mosque that's bridging a divide among Muslims.
He said, my mother is Sunni and my father is Shia, and we call ourselves Sushi.
Then we'll hear how one architect designs the places in which people pray.
When you're praying, you're seeing the face of the other, and that the divine dwells in that holy space where humans connect.
And we meet some devout practitioners of data storage inside an old church.
Every time a light blinks, somebody's either uploading something or downloading something from the Internet Archive.
We're going inside spiritual spaces today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Throughout much of their history, Sunni and Shia Muslims have lived peacefully together in countries like Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. But since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, sectarian conflict has escalated in the region. Here in the Bay Area, as in most of the U.S., around 75% of Muslims identify as Sunni. Only 4% identify as Shia. Mosques here are mostly identified by sect. You have the Sunni mosque, the Shia mosque, or the Sufi mosque. But the Islamic Cultural Center of Northern California has made itself purposefully into a place where they all meet. It's located in Oakland, a block from Lake Merritt. And unlike most of the 80 mosques in the Bay Area, the ICCNC was founded by Shia Muslims, not Sunnis. Recently, they held a celebration for Prophet Muhammad's birthday, also rare among mosques. Here, they hold it every year, but this year was different. It was 3 days after the attacks on French magazine Charlie Hebdo. First off, it doesn't look like your average mosque. The towering, majestic, turn-of-the-century building used to be a Masonic temple. There's no minaret, and they left the temple's tall, painted glass windows as is. Manager Azita Seya gives me the tour.
Kindergarten, we have a library here that serves our cultural goals. And we have rooms that are specifically for when we have an exhibition.
Because it was founded by Iranian immigrants, the second language here is Persian, as the wall decor shows. And the floors. Persian rugs are scattered around on cherry wooden floors, and Islamic art adorns the walls. Artistic expression is a focus here for a reason, says mosque leader Ali Sheikhul Islami. He says it fills an important gap in the conversation about Islam.
I think one missing thing in the whole right now today is the beauty, you know, really. Really paying attention to the beauty of Islam and its rich history.
Which is why this doesn't sound like your average mosque either. On this night, I walk into the huge auditorium where dozens of people are sitting in chairs and pews facing a stage. On stage, a Moroccan musician in a traditional white and gold hooded robe stands playing his oud. Next to him, a drummer with a dumbek. Ask anyone who's been to a mosque, this scene is definitely not a common one. And that's exactly why Ali Sadri came here tonight from San Jose.
It's a unique experience. So if you go to a traditional, like, you know, Muslim place, that's not something that you're going to, you know, get. So, I mean, that's why it's more fun. And I thought it's a good place, you know, for my kid and my wife to enjoy.
Fun. When's the last time you heard any place of worship described that way? Tonight is a celebration of Prophet Muhammad's birthday, also not a common event in mosques because many Muslim leaders shun birthday celebrations altogether. The Moroccan musician is singing the praises of the Prophet, an ancient and beloved tradition in many Muslim communities. Look around the room and you'll see people who are white, black, Asian, people in elaborate green and white Sufi robes and sashes, others in black robes and Shia headdress. Some women wear scarves on their heads, some don't. There's even a guest Jewish rabbi in the house tonight. And this is also what sets the ICCNC apart. Sure, it was founded by Shia Iranians, but everyone is welcome here, says one of the founders, Ahmed Sheikhul Islami.
Maybe the best example for the non-Muslim audience would be that if you had a multi-denominational church where, you know, Presbyterians and, you know, Lutherans and, I mean, there would be services and activities that they could do together.
In this case, it's Shias and Sunnis joining together, two groups that have been in the headlines for the past decade, killing each other in Iraq, Syria, or Lebanon. Yasin Ali Jones has made the trip tonight from Sacramento. He's decked out in an elaborate green Sufi robe and turban.
It's the first place where I got to interact with Shia and Sunni together. So it's definitely special to me.
He identifies as Sufi Sunni and says nights like this, in times when extremism is on the rise, are when Sunni-Shia unity is especially important.
I'm definitely hearing similarities in our reactions to extremists and extremism, too. And definitely people are very firm in their stand against that type of behavior and attitudes towards other people.
The night is festive, but somber as well. Santa Clara engineer Salman Mashayikh says he's enjoying the night, and it's making him ponder what the Prophet would say about the recently heightened Sunni-Shia divide.
To me, it's nonsense, Shia and Sunni people like fighting each other and killing each other. That's just not something that the Prophet would have wanted. We need to work together and sit with each other and, you know, listen each other out and just have our own beliefs and not fight over anything.
Ahmed Sheikhul Islami says being in the U.S. far away from the violence gives room for that kind of Sunni-Shia dialogue.
The unique thing about the American experience is that we are able to come to this country and practice the religion the way we want to, and to do it in a way that we're tolerant of each other.
Tolerance means having dialogue, even friendship and warmth. But what happens when they're part of the same family? Ask 35-year-old educator Imrul Mazid.
I identify as Shia, yeah. My parents are Sunni, but we're all Muslim, you know, it's all one.
A friend introduced Mazid to Shiism in his early 20s. He acknowledges the theological and historical differences between himself and his parents that do cause heated debate with Sunnis. Like the question of who should have succeeded the Prophet after his death is a big one. So when talking to his parents or other Sunnis, he avoids those contentious topics. He says he's especially tired of people nitpicking differences in the smallest things, like how to stand during prayer.
You got to be smart, you know, unity first. So I don't think it's necessary to, oh, man, your hands, you pray like this, man, your hands are like this, my hands are like that. You do, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, it's about the message itself.
And this is a place that supports all forms of Muslim prayer. Mazid is part of a growing number of mixed Sunni-Shia families in the United States. And there's even a name for them. Ahmed Sheikhul Islami explains.
One day we were talking to a friend and he said, my mother is Sunni and my father is Shia. And so he said, we call ourselves sushi. So we like that. That's a good way.
Sushis.
We are one. These things should not divide us. You know, we're all humans. You know, we're all sushi. Yeah.
As the audience joins the singer in praise of the Prophet Muhammad on his birthday, their collective voices soar high into the Oakland night sky. And I think that word also describes this place where Sunni and Shia meet, pray, talk, eat, and sing together. It's a sushi mosque. That story was a part of KALW's Spiritual Edge project, Stories of Belief, Belonging, and Practice. The ICCNC is holding a Persian music concert on January 30th. More details are at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. Spiritual spaces are where people come to meet, pray, grieve, and celebrate important moments like births and weddings. It's a lot of work for one church or temple or mosque to provide the proper venue for life's diverse experiences. For centuries, religion has sparked the design of some of the world's most beautiful buildings. But what is that process? What built elements make a space sacred? In this next story from The Spiritual Edge, KALW's Angela Johnston goes to find out.
Architect Susie Colliver says experiencing the design of a sacred space begins way before you even step foot in a building.
So we're in the parking lot of Kol Shofar.
That's a synagogue in Tiburon. We're surrounded by eucalyptus trees and grassy hills in the distance. The building is actually nowhere in sight. There's a twisting set of concrete stairs ahead of us. They wind around the trees, taking you 40 feet up the hill.
You leave the parking lot behind. You leave the everyday, you leave the secular behind. As you climb, slowly, it's a very gentle rise of stairs.
We walk up the stairs. Colliver points out the concrete landings. They are imprinted with leaves from the trees above, and each landing has a bench.
It feels very doable. It feels very accessible. And psychologically, that's important, especially for people who are not as agile.
At the top, the synagogue finally comes into view. Its natural exterior blends into its surrounding. Colliver designed it 4 years ago. She's Jewish, but through her work designing low-income housing for religious groups, she's created sacred spaces for communities of all different faiths.
The hope is that from the parking lot up the curved stairs that one is going through a process of quieting.
This is what you might hear walking through the entryway on a Saturday morning.
We're going to start with Ma Tovu, the prayer that's said upon entering a place of prayer.
That's the congregation's Rabbi Chai Levi.
It says, "How good are your tents, Jacob?"
Along with music, light seeps through gaps in the walls of this curved hallway.
Not unlike being in a forest, the light is coming through slatted wood. So the light is hitting every piece of wood along the curved path a little differently.
That's because before Colliver even begins putting pen to paper, she asks a committee of community members a central question: to recall a place where they felt most connected to a spirit beyond themselves.
It's very rare that somebody will say a cathedral. It's far more likely in our experience that they'll say a sunset on the beach, or they'll say a mountaintop with an endless view, or they'll say a grove of trees with dappled light coming through.
You can feel this as you emerge into an open, round space, the sanctuary. It feels like the center of a redwood grove. The curved rows of seating are colored with a burnt red fabric, matching the bark of the trees nearby. They wrap around the central bima, or pulpit.
People frequently let out a sigh. I think people feel a small sense of awe. And it's pretty palpable. You see it on faces a lot. You can hear it in people's breath.
Sitting in a service, you'd see Levi in the center, and also the faces of about 100 others.
When you're praying, you're seeing the face of the other, and that the divine dwells in that holy space where humans connect.
Levi says as soon as you put two people together, God is in the mix. It's something the rabbi and the committee wanted in Colliver's design.
I see both the beauty of people having prayerful experiences, and then also, you know, I see honestly the faces of people struggling with whatever they're going through in their lives.
Not only can people see one another clearly in the round, they can also see changes outside. Right above us is what Susie Colliver says is an important detail. there's a tradition in Judaism that the day starts not at midnight and not at daybreak, but actually when you can see the first three stars in the evening.
We gave them skylights through which you could discern when the new day had started by virtue of being able to see the stars. That was hugely important to them.
The design engages not just sight, but sound. Colliver says the congregation wanted to make sure everyone could hear each other.
We find that in many of the sacred spaces we're doing now, there is more emphasis put on participation than there is on sitting quietly and listening. The more important the room acoustics become, because it's less a single point of sound and more a communal experience.
That's true at Kol Shofar, where Rabbi Levy likes to lead interactive discussions. She also likes to lead the community in dancing, like at this recent children's service.
People holding hands and getting in a long line and dancing around. So, yeah, we were a community that wants to celebrate and feel joy together, and so having a space that people could dance in was definitely important.
So we're going to end with a prayer, with the words from the psalm that we sang earlier this morning.
When you look up to the ceiling from the bima, you'll notice a simple metal chandelier and a vaulted dome, which is offset from the center of the room. Colliver says this asymmetry is very intentional.
If it were symmetrical, there would be a suggestion that A, perfection is attainable, which we know it is not. We all have issues, we all have struggles, we all have conflict, and that conflict is made physical in this space. And people feel that very, very carefully.
Architect Susie Colliver says encouraging the search for meaning in the mundane is what spiritual architecture is all about. Whether it's the design of a synagogue, church, or a mosque. In Tiburon, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
For more stories on belief, belonging, and practice, visit the Spiritual Edge Project at spiritualedge.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. For our last stop today, we're heading from the synagogue to church. In San Francisco's Richmond District, where Geary Boulevard meets Park Presidio, there stands
a beautiful, bright, bright white building that looks like a courthouse, but it's actually an old church, Christian Scientist Church.
That's KALW's Audrey Dilling. She went to go check out the place.
There are big white columns. It just looks really clean, and because they have these like iron doors. And there's some statues out front on either side of these big pink marble steps.
But what goes on inside this church is not quite what you'd expect.
And I'm gonna head inside.
The first thing I see is a black doormat with a picture of what looks like a Roman temple. Come to think of it, it actually looks a lot like the building I just stepped inside. That's a happy coincidence, according to my guide, Brewster Kale.
We bought this building because it matched our logo. That was our logo.
Kale is leading me and about 15 other people on a tour of this old church, which now houses the gigantic internet project he founded called the Internet Archive.
So the Internet Archive is almost 20 years old. The idea was to try to build the Library of Alexandria version 2.
Version 1 was in Egypt. It was one of the biggest and most important libraries of the ancient world. It's said to have housed every book, or scroll, I should say, ever written, up until the first century BC. That's when it burned and everything inside was destroyed. Nowadays, that would be like if we lost all of Shakespeare, or you could never watch The Wire again.
The Internet Archive is trying to prevent this from ever happening.
And it turns out technologically you can do it.
Brewster Kahle and a team of more than 50 engineers, programmers, archivists, and some volunteers, too, are doing that right in this building. He pays for all of this with money he earned early in his tech career and from foundations.
And yeah, I'll show you around.
As Kahle leads us up to the second floor, I can hear the faint hum of hard drives. But the first thing I see is a full-on church. We're in a cavernous room lit by daylight streaming in through big arched windows adorned with panes of stained glass. It actually does feel kind of holy. There are real pews in here, arranged in a wide half circle facing an altar. The floor is sloped like an amphitheater.
We thought when we bought this place we would flatten the floor and make it into a library. But exactly what a library looks like or is like in the future, we don't know. So we thought, okay, why don't we just take it slow and have the building adapt to us and we'll adapt to the building.
One of those adaptations is right behind me. Inset in a space that looks like it should hold a statue of a saint or something, instead stand three towers of compact black computer servers, illuminated by blinking blue lights.
Every time a light blinks, somebody's either uploading something or downloading something from the Internet Archive. We get between 2 and 3 million users a day. So people actually want old stuff.
Old stuff like a copy of Dracula from 1897, or a book from the year 1000 AD, or recordings of Grateful Dead concerts from the 1980s. There's over 95 million downloads of those. All of this is stuff that might otherwise disappear, or at least be inaccessible to most people.
People aren't going and necessarily hunting things down in libraries in the way that they used to 50 years ago. And anybody that knows some topic well knows that the internet doesn't have all of the stuff on it. So if we're going to be bringing up our kids with this as their whole experience of information, we better put the best we have to offer within reach of our children. And it's not there now.
The Internet Archive is working to change that.
So we're now digitizing about 1,000 books every day. We've got 30 scanning centers in 8 countries. And we're up to, 2 to 3 million books that are publicly available, downloadable for free.
In 184 languages. Sometimes libraries pay the Internet Archive to digitize their entire collections. Now, if all of this sounds like an incomprehensible or even impossible amount of data to you, it doesn't to Brewster Kahle.
It's absolutely possible to go and have all the books, music, and video online. If you take a book, it's about a megabyte. And the largest library in the world is the Library of Congress, which is 28 million books. So 28 million megabytes is 28 terabytes, which is about 7 hard drives that you can buy at Best Buy.
There are a lot more than 7 hard drives in our next stop. Like a couple hundred more. And they're loud. This is a library where you have to yell.
So if you come to a library, you're going to see books. If you go to a digital library, you're going to see computers and bits.
These computers also hold the data for another project of the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine. That's a searchable spot on the site that preserves past versions of around 145 billion websites. 145 billion, and counting. Every 2 months, a program built by the archive crawls the entire internet.
And the idea is to just visit all of them and then record the pages and then start again. And then start again, start again, start again. So this has been going on since 1996.
You can go back in time to see what Google looked like in 1998. And you know what's crazy? It doesn't look all that different. Or you can go see some of the first viral internet videos.
Mosh. Spoon is too big.
Teen Girl Squad!
It's peanut butter jelly time! Peanut butter jelly time! Peanut butter jelly time!
About 600,000 people use the Wayback Machine every day. For fun and not so fun, like holding politicians or corporations accountable for their promises. Brewster Kahle says the average website changes every 100 days.
We also see people use it to hold companies accountable for things that they used to say. And it's basically been used in court a lot to go and say, but this is what you offered. And it's been useful in politics in that same sort of way of keeping people accountable for what it is they used to say.
So things like the original privacy terms of your Facebook account, or what the president said in his State of the Union address.
If we're just locked into the present, if we only had what it is people want us to know it right now without any history, we'd live in a very Orwellian world.
If Cale has his way, the only place you'll find that very Orwellian world is in a book on the Internet Archive. In San Francisco, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents.
We've got a link to the entire collection of the Internet Archive at KALW.org. Click on Cross Currents. And we love to hear from you, so email us at news@KALW.org. Or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Or pick up the phone and call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Olivia Cueva, Lila Day, Sandia Dirks, Rachel Dornhelm, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Christina Loring, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Stephen Short, and Liza Veal. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by the North Beach Brass Band. The 9-piece brass combo will be playing twice tonight at Biscuits and Blues in San Francisco. Shows are at 7:30 and 9:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.